some football!
Oh, intermission.
No, it's halftime.
Here comes Beckett. Down goes Shaw. The ball is out. Arkansas's got it at the 1 foot line.
Blue!
Yes, sir.
Do you trust that I do not want to see you die here tonight?
Sir, yes, sir.
Blue, you're my boy!
You can actually feel Razorback Stadium shaking underneath our feet right now.
I don't want them to gain another yard.
Here's the God in football.
Can't wait. The next game, and the years to come, because victory is going to be habitual.
You're listening to the Halftime Podcast.
Yes, there is a lot of talk about that massive Hurricane Florence that has swamped the Carolinas across the country. And to be sure, I'm not trying to make light of the horrors and challenges that the people in that part of the country are facing through that real natural disaster, but it just started me thinking a little bit about storms, and I think I might see it a little bit differently than Coach Morris does for his team. You know, there are two distinct time periods where a hurricane can cause a lot of damage. During the storm, which is obvious with all the high winds and massive amounts of rain and the high storm surge on the coast, but then there's what they're dealing with right now, the aftermath, when the rivers and the creeks and the lakes overflow and their banks, and then it causes all the widespread damage, and it lasts for days. That's what they're dealing with now. Over a dozen rivers have flooded in North and South Carolina. And again, I'm not trying to make light of the suffering people are facing due to Florence. One of my best friends had to evacuate Wilmington, North Carolina with his family, and they've been far away from home for over a week. And up until today, they didn't know when they were going to get back. And sometimes we focus so much on the high winds and rain that we forget there are still floods to come later. And it does feel to me like that's what Razorback football is dealing with right now, the flood. Last season was the storm, the season where Coach B's run game was finally going to take that step forward. Defense would improve. You had the hard-nosed leader at quarterback that you wanted. But I'd say the storm really started with the one-point win over Coastal Carolina last November the 4th. Then the skies opened with losses against LSU, Mississippi State, Mizzou. The run game was so-so. The O-line couldn't keep Austin Allen upright. The defense certainly did not improve, and you know what happened next. Out with the old, in with the new. And now the rivers have been rising, and you see what's in front of you, which is a flooded swamp. And at first, there doesn't appear to be a way out. And this is where Morris's message does get through to me more. All he can do, and all his staff and all his players can do, is just keep looking, keep searching for that way out. You can hear it in his message that he's really just not quite sure what he's got on this team, but he continues to search. Eventually, the waters recede. Life can be put back together again. And in fact, as I sat here thinking about this, My friend texted me to say that he and his wife and their two children are on their way back home to Wilmington. He doesn't know what it'll look like when they return, but return they will, and they'll deal with it. And that's exactly what I think Coach Morris is doing as well, dealing with a flood that is swamping Arkansas football a little bit. Anyway, that's my view. My co-host is Ty Richardson. Ty, how's it going today, my man?
What's up, man? I think you had a little more of an interesting night than I did last night. You would think the younger member of this show would be a little more adventurous on a Wednesday night, but it was not the case.
Let me guess, as I'm out enjoying an evening in The Rock, you were probably stuck to the radio listening to the Chad Morris show, right? Before you buckled down and watched your nightly rom-com.
I touched on it, but I was asleep by about 8:15 last night.
Goodness gracious! You might actually think if you went by our sleep patterns, or even maybe our moods at 12 o'clock when our show starts, you'd think you were the guy who was 41 years old. Yeah,
I told Tommy and John this morning, that is the best I've slept since moving to Fort Smith. I have never felt more wide awake this morning. When I woke up before my alarm, I woke up at 4:25. My alarm goes off at 4:30, and I was revitalized. I was ready to go. That doesn't mean I'm going to start going to bed at 8 o'clock every night, but I can understand why, as you get older, you start to go to bed earlier, because it definitely helps, despite what the younger generation thinks.
Makes you feel good. Makes you realize that work is the most important part of the day, to make sure that you are ready for it as
absolutely
you are today. So when you look at I was reading the comments that Coach Morris made on the weekly radio show. You might have listened to it. A lot of talk early about self-inflicted wounds. And he's speaking specifically about ball security. And if you're talking ball security for Arkansas, you are talking about one thing, and it is interceptions, flat out. it's really something when you see that they have not only has Arkansas not lost a fumble yet, they haven't even dropped a fumble yet. I mean, they, anybody that has secured the ball has held on to it. I don't really know many teams across the country that at least haven't fumbled once yet, never mind losing the ball on a fumble, but just dropping it once. It's been nothing but interceptions. And when you read his comments, when you listen to his comments, he's not pointing out exactly the issue, but the issue is straight up. At that point, it becomes some decision-making by quarterbacks. He talks about the need to hit open receivers, especially on third down plays. That also goes against quarterbacks. But, I mean, it's pretty interesting when you look at the ball security thing. He's worried about ball security, but yet Arkansas has 8 takeaways, and they've turned it over 8 times. That's the season line. Of course, on the losses, it's been a little bit different. In the last 2 games, 8 turnovers and only 3 takeaways. You'd like to see it. You'd like to see it even up a little bit, but apparently, I mean, that's one thing that Arkansas does well is knock the ball loose.
That's our shining light, Phil. No turnovers when it comes to the running backs. Jeff Traylor doing a good job there. So that's our. We were trying to find a light yesterday for the season. That is definitely one.
That's the one thing that you might actually be able to. I don't know. You couldn't say that you count on necessarily, but yeah, that's one bright, nice bright spot for the Arkansas offense that they haven't fumbled it yet. I think it's going to be a little bit different against this Auburn team. This is a beast of a defense that Arkansas is going to be facing at Jordan-Hare Stadium on Saturday, and it isn't necessarily a matter of how much they take the ball away. In fact, so far they have just 6 takeaways, and they've turned it over 6 times as well. So they just are huge. This is a very big defensive line, and you could see how it's going to be a problem. It could be a problem, especially with the shuffling on the offensive line that going into the fourth week of the season, some positions are changing up. It could be a real problem to run the football against Auburn, and you almost get the sense that they will dare Arkansas to air it out and see if they can hit that open receiver.
That's what North Texas did. That's what Colorado State did, and it paid off for them. And now you have even better athletes on Auburn, better coaching, just a better overall defense. So whoever the quarterback, I mean, obviously it's going to be Ty Story to start, but whoever ends up getting in there, because I think you and I both agree that he's going to start, but he's not going to finish the game. You've got to make plays, and this is just going to be a defense. It's going to be really difficult to do that.
And you know that Auburn is looking to use the bulk that they have at offensive line also on the other side to try to jam the ball down Arkansas's throat. And that's something we'll talk about with Bob Holt, who published a story in the Democrat Gazette about how Auburn has had such success running the football against Arkansas over the last few years. I mean, you look at last year's box score, 345 yards on the ground, and the year before that, it was. If I look at my notes correctly, it was over 500 yards on the ground. Goodness gracious, 543 yards on the ground in 2016. I mean, look at that. I mean, so many coaches will tell you the game can be won and lost right there at the line of scrimmage, and if you're just going by the size of the players that are up on the defensive line or the line of scrimmage on the offensive side for Auburn, it's awfully rough. And there's experience, too, on both sides of the ball, where there isn't necessarily as much experience, and maybe not, the word could be cohesiveness because of injuries and all the switching around at positions. That's where things, I think, if you're looking at it from Auburn's perspective, that's where they want things to start to get ugly. In a positive way for the Auburn Tigers. 307 at left tackle, 307 pounds at left guard, 300 pounds at center, 324 at right guard, 300 at right tackle. On the defensive line, 320 for Dontavius Russell at defensive tackle. Derek Brown, who's been destroying them so far, is 320. The lightest player on the defensive line for Auburn is Marlon Davidson, and he's at 278. And yet that doesn't even bring in their leading tackler, their Mike linebacker, Deshaun Davis, who's only 5'11". You kind of wonder, with a guy like that size, how does he see who's got the football when he's got a defensive line that's so big? that is where there is probably a rather large discrepancy for Auburn against Arkansas.
Yeah, that's not just that. There's going to be a lot of different glaring weaknesses that Auburn is going to be able to take advantage of looking at the Arkansas football team. And a lot of national pundits who are a lot smarter than I am when it comes to discerning who's better college football group. Auburn has been described as a top three, top five front seven, not only in the SEC, but in college football. If you think about who Arkansas has to play this year, Alabama, while their secondary is not as veteran, is not as seasoned as they have been in years past, there's still talent all over that field. But Alabama's defense, Auburn's defense, and what we've seen from LSU so far, LSU might be my favorite defense to watch in the SEC. Luckily, Arkansas doesn't have to play Georgia. But you can make a case. Clemson's obviously a top five defense. Throw Washington in there. There's probably one or two I'm forgetting that Arkansas has to face three of the top six or seven best defenses in college football. And this one. And Texas A&M's got a pretty salty defense, too. I don't know if they're top 10. But Arkansas, again, the brunt of the SEC. Now, Alabama's got an offense. We know that. But the SEC calling card for many years has been the defensive side of the football. And they're going to face exactly that on Saturday night.
When you look at the LSU game for Auburn, and you mentioned how good the defense is for the LSU Tigers. They held Auburn to just 130 yards, just over 3 yards per carry. And, they held them to under 375 yards of offense for the game. Boy, that would... They made it an ugly game. LSU was able to turn that game into a grind on both sides of the ball, and then it comes down to the final possession, and LSU ends up with that final possession to get some big plays from Joe Burrow and a big kick. And, I started thinking a little bit about, and I saw, you'd mentioned before the show today, Nikki Chavanel, our friend from Rivals, tweets out, what would you give for an Arkansas win over Auburn this Saturday? Essentially, it's like, it's like Lent. It's like giving something up for a win instead of giving something up for your sins. It's the idea of, so, and I'm thinking to myself, well, okay, then you got to get the win. What would it actually take for Arkansas to win on Saturday? And Ty, your idea is they got to turn it into an ugly game as soon as they possibly can and find a way to force some turnovers.
It has to be. Because the offense doesn't have the firepower or the quarterback to be able to keep up with Auburn throughout the entirety of the game. So you're not going to be able to make it as ugly as LSU because LSU has far too many athletes compared to you. But you got to find a way to force some turnovers. And we saw glimpses of that, but that was against Eastern Illinois. Now you're in your first SEC game. You have to know if you can do similar things. I'm not saying the same level where you force five or six turnovers in a game. But if you can force three turnovers in this game, you're going to give yourself a chance to win. Because let's face it, Phil, you're covering up a lot of different holes if you're the Arkansas football team. You're Chad Morris. You've got to find different ways to win. Because conventionally, as a head coach and an offensive coordinator, looking at what he's done at SMU, Clemson, and Tulsa, he's had high-powered offenses. Now he's going to have to dig deep into his arsenal in kind of an area he's never known before, which is the defensive side of the football. That's why John Chavis is so important to this staff and this program, because if he's not there, if you have just some random dude coaching the defense, I don't know if Arkansas even can step on the field with a single team this season in the SEC. Now, I still don't think they have a great chance against any of the teams they face the rest of the way, but at least you give yourself a chance with a veteran defensive guy who's been in the league for what seems like forever. I think first started at Tennessee in 97 or 98. It's one of those 2 years, maybe 96. So it's a guy that's been around for a while. You got to find a way to start it on the defensive side of the football. Then maybe that confidence will etch over to the offensive side, and maybe you can get something going. Because Ty Story needs a confidence boost early in this game, whether it's him or the defense. Otherwise, Arkansas stands no chance in this game. They have very little chance to begin with.
And maybe you get a boost from your defense, maybe from the special teams. But then, you have so many injuries now. At kick returner, not even quite sure who's going to return kicks. One of the positions that has been not just tested but exposed at times in these last couple of games has been at cornerback. And there's another position where there have been some injuries, and that's one thing that you worry about, because what's happened here with Chevin Callaway, who was starting a couple of games at cornerback out for an undisclosed personal issue. So we're not quite sure exactly what's going on, and there's nothing that's come out about him.
What's Chevin and his status? Is he back with you guys?
He's not back at this moment.
And Burrito, is he? What's his deal?
He'll be out for a few weeks.
Moore's being very vague on that, Phil.
They're not always vague either about reasons why players are out of a game, or you know what the injury is necessarily. A lot of coaches about any injury will be very vague. Lower portion of the body, upper portion of the body. I've heard some programs just go with that description for an injury. But with these two, and again with Callaway, it might not be an injury, but they're not saying anything about it. So I mean, again, those are two positions. Brito would be returning kicks. Callaway is one of the guys that you expect to be starting at cornerback. They're right there are two positions where maybe you'd be able to find a way to get a boost and maybe a chance to shorten the field for an offense that right now, if you're looking for an offense, that offense to go 80 yards, let's say after a touchback, that seems like it could be a tall order. So maybe, I mean, look at the North Texas game. One of the big issues was field position, and maybe a couple of turnovers, maybe a couple of good kick returns, and that field position problem wouldn't be much of a problem anymore. But now you're dealing with injuries or whatevers at those two positions. So again, it turns into more of a question mark than any sort of salvation. So again, that kind of relates to some of the things I'm talking about with this flood. So I mean, you're looking for ways out. You really are. You can hear Coach Morris saying that. I try to be as optimistic as possible. And right now, I'm not sure if I see a way out of the flood, at least for the next 4 weeks or so.
You're listening to the Halftime Podcast. Follow the guys on Twitter at Phil Elson PXP and at Ty Sports Radio.
And it's Joe Adams with a hurdle. Great speed. Adams down the sideline. He's gone. 92 yards for a touchdown.
This segment, this is going to be one of my favorite segments of the week, I think, Ty. Last week, we took a look around for some of the most expensive tickets across the SEC. And today, it's a little bit different, but what did you spend? You spent what?
How did I spend that much money?
You got a skull for your brain, a plastic sleeve for your comb, and a wallet for your money.
Are you stupid or something? I'm as stupid as a stupid does.
I'll even throw in season tickets for the Lakers.
You spent what?
All right, Ty, I want you to start this one off. You found...
I'm kicking it. All right.
Yeah, to me, you gave me the thought that this segment, well, last week was more about tickets.
Mm-hmm.
When you are looking for the really ridiculous dollar figures,
absolutely,
involving sports, if you're not talking about athlete salaries or coaches' salaries or the price of a stadium being built, you're talking about sports memorabilia. And specifically, you're talking about cards, baseball cards, basketball cards, football cards. You found one that has sold for an outlandish amount or is about to.
Yeah, how about the Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, and Julius Erving rookie card that's going to go for a little over $125,000? And let me tell you something. I am the biggest Larry Bird fan. He's my second favorite basketball player of all time behind Michael Jordan. Larry Bird is awesome, and I have a Larry Bird jersey. I have watched every single old highlight clip. They used to have those NBA hardwood classics on NBA TV. They still do, and I watched those, read books about him, the historic rivalry between him and Magic Johnson. But, Phil, even if I became a millionaire someday, I'm not paying $125,000 for his rookie card. I'm just not. And what's crazy about this is I just assumed this wasn't the biggest one that has ever been sold in terms of money, and it wasn't even close.
No, not so, even close.
Not even close. You had a LeBron James rookie card, 2003, go for over $300,000. And that's let's keep going, Phil. How about George Mikan, 1948, old... Not L.A. Laker, Minneapolis Lakers, if you remember, right? George Mikan. There's not probably too many people listening that got a chance to watch him play live, but if you did, hats off to you, because that would have been a cool experience that I will never get to experience. And then let me ask you, what do you think? Did you read the story?
I'm looking at it right now.
Okay, then I was going to see if you could figure the last one out. So the highest basketball card ever paid for is a 1969 Luau Cinder, which is spent for over $500,000. The name Luau Cinder doesn't ring a bell. I'll try and give you a hint. UCLA, John Wooden, yeah, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar when he eventually changed his name. So, yeah, that went for over $500,000. So, quite a bit of money spent on those four different basketball cards, Phil.
I'm looking at the card that they're speaking of, and it's right there from eBay, and that's a great card.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think it's necessarily the rookie card for Bird and Johnson because they're both on the same card here, but they're on the card with Dr. J, who's signified on this card as the scoring leader for the 1980 season, averaging 26.9 points a game. So there you get. I mean, those are probably the three biggest basketball icons of that time.
Absolutely,
all on the same card. It just so happens Magic and Bird were in their first year. $125,000 for that. Now, these are asking prices, which you see on eBay. This isn't what the people are actually spending on it. I guess eventually there could be some back and forth or some negotiations. But this is outlandish here, and I doubt the guy's going to get what he's asking for.
You don't think so?
I doubt he's going to get what he's asking for because I'm seeing here he's calling it the rarest 2000 Tom Brady rookie card. It's a Donruss Elite. From 2000, it is a rookie card for Tom Brady. He says that there were only 10 of these cards in the world, and he's got one of them. And he is asking for $1 million, a cool mill, just for one of 10 rookie cards from Donruss Elite 2000. Now, I'm not a Tom Brady fan. I'm not putting a penny towards that. I don't think anybody is going to be spending a cold $1 million on that. And I don't even think the Honus Wagner card went for more than that.
Did that go?
Actually, it did go for more. Here we go. The top 10 most valuable baseball cards in the world. Honus Wagner, which has been sold a number of times, $3.1 million.
Jeez.
That is $2 million more than the second most expensive card, which was Mickey Mantle's rookie card from 1952, went for $1.13 million. After that, Babe Ruth and the 1916 Sporting News baseball cards, back when Sporting News was a real print publication, $717,000. Same money for a Pete Rose combination rookie card of 1963, Shoeless Joe, and an American, this would have been a tobacco card for $667,000. A Nolan Ryan, Jerry Kuzman card went for $612,000. A few more after that as well. So, I mean, yeah, the memorabilia is really where some of the most ridiculous prices go. And then there's the idea, and this will be a lot of fun, because there's the idea of other sorts of memorabilia and how you get your hands on it. We think of things that are signed as being the real thing of memorabilia. Baseball cards, jerseys. Even fans get their hands on shoes that athletes wear during the game or boxing gloves that they use during a match. And then there's the idea of finding something that hasn't even been a thing yet. Now, I don't know if you heard about this. The Red Sox I think the magic number to clinch for the American League East remains at two. They've dropped two in a row to the Yankees, and that's the team that the Yankees are chasing in the East, so that magic number remains at two. But you've got to be prepared. You got to be ready to go. And in case you, when they do win the division, because the Red Sox are going to, they're going to do just that. So they made their AL East pennant already. And, of course, you make a pennant, you're going to hang it up, and it goes along with all of the other collections of pennants around Fenway Park. So they have it ready to go when they clinch, but apparently the pennant did not make it to Fenway Park. It got lost somewhere, and nobody knew where it was, but then there's this guy. There's Louis Iacuzzi of Malden, Massachusetts, held onto the thing for 48 hours, and he wanted something out of it. This is one of the reasons I wanted to play this is because this is a real Bostonian speaking. I don't know why they called people from Malden, Massachusetts, a Maldonian, a Maldanian, something like that. But they all sound about the same. And he's got a compelling story. And as much of a Red Sox supporter as he is, these guys expected something for the trouble of finding it and bringing it back to Fenway Park. So listen to these guys.
Now, we have our coffee run. We're driving on McGrath Highway in Somerville. And I noticed a couple cars swinging, like moving to the right, and we seen something in the street.
First of all, I love the dog in the background. That just adds to it. All right, keep on going. Louis Iacuzzi.
And he's like, Louis, what is that? What is it? I'm like, I don't know. What is it? So I ran across the highway to grab it. We brought it in the car. We had no idea what it was.
Yeah, Boston.
It was wrapped up in a brown paper bag.
Number one, Boston.
First thing I said, this belongs to the Red Sox. This is for Fenway Park.
Yeah.
Like, how do we have this? Like, nobody made this. This belongs to the park. I'm thinking that they hang it off the Green Monster.
Yeah.
We want to give it back to them because it belongs to them, and it doesn't belong to us. Yep. But in reciprocation, we would like, you know, maybe to go to a nice playoff game. Or we're looking for something. We just don't want to hand it over to them.
In reciprocation, we just want to go to a nice playoff game.
Right. We need to negotiate here. We want to. We're looking for, like, you know,
we're working too.
Yeah.
I mean, my man had to run across three lanes, traffic.
But we know that that's the original one.
We were told there was only one made.
Yeah, we were told there was only one
band
made.
So at that point, that tells us. But then they told us they had a duplicate. So if they do try to put a duplicate up, you best believe we're going to show up and say,
we have the right one.
That's not the right. That's not the original.
So we're hoping that they don't make one and they put the right one up.
We're hoping they do the right thing. Yep. You know, we did the right thing. We could have kept it. We could have put it on eBay. We could have, you know, we got connections where we could have reached out to other sources.
I love these guys.
Black market or the sources.
That's right. I mean, first of all, you love to hear guys talk like that. Second of all, they didn't get a darn thing. They didn't get a thing from the Red Sox. And the Sox, they made another banner. And then all of a sudden, Louis brings the banner back to Fenway Park and didn't get a gosh darn thing for it whatsoever. But it also got me thinking about my favorite accents as far as sports fans go. And I know we have other things to bring up here as far as you spent what. But, yeah, I got to compare some of these accents here because you got the Massachusetts, and then you get Diane Rawls, who is from right outside Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. That's my hometown. They're called Yinzers in Pittsburgh, and they sound differently than anybody else. This is the woman that named the mascot for the Pittsburgh Steelers, which is called Steely McBeam, which, you know, ain't the greatest name, but when you hear her reason why and you hear her voice, I think you'll like why she actually did name it Steely McBeam.
Steely McBeam, okay? Well, Steely because it's a steel pond, Mick because the Steelers are Irish, okay? And Beam because steel beam, plus my husband loves Jim Beam. So there you go. It's an all-win situation, right?
That's why we should all name our mascots something involving booze. All right, so that's what I got for my first You Spent. Well, what else you got here?
All right, moving on to number two. I did go football in this one. And Bama, Alabama, surprisingly, it was kind of cheap. On Vivid Seats, you can sit in the south end zone of Bryant-Denny Stadium for a cool $526 to watch Alabama maul Texas A&M. I think the line's a little low, Phil. I don't know about you, but I think Alabama is going to crush the Aggies this weekend.
All right, I guess we'll make some picks on that stuff tomorrow. What did I see the line at? 26? 26 and growing, just a little bit.
That just seems low to me after what they did to Ole Miss on the road, but I guess they've value Jimbo Fisher and the Aggies. We'll see what happens in Bryant-Denny on Saturday.
Does seem like a high price, though, to go to
526 just to see a blowout. Game. That's the thing, Phil. Alabama fans, I know Arkansas boosters occasionally complain of how much they have to contribute, and as my grandpa being a former booster, my late grandpa, I understand that because you do have to contribute a lot of money, and I can understand why fans are kind of hacked off right now considering the football team is what it is. But for Alabama, I think there's two sides of the coin. I would almost be bored going into games knowing I was just going to dominate. Like, there's no suspense or anything. I can't remember the exact stat. I want to say Nick Saban's only lost five or six games at home since he started coaching. And I could be I could be like skewing that a little bit, but to go into every home game knowing you're going to win or having a 95 to 99% chance that you're going to win, I wouldn't like that. And like, I'll kind of relate it to something real quick. So I grew up in Little Rock. Pulaski Academy is this just monster football program. Kevin Kelly is one of the best high school coaches, not only in Arkansas, but in the country.
Yeah, they just had a really lengthy losing streak come to an end a couple weeks ago.
Finally.
Or a lengthy winning streak.
They're going to play my alma mater, Little Rock Christian, later in the year. Actually, Texas A&M weekend next week. And they're probably going to kill them, unfortunately. But I would watch their student section. And their student section wouldn't pay attention until this roar rang. And it would go off, and then they'd like realize they scored, and then they get excited and stuff. So it's kind of that sense where if you're Alabama and you're a fan, you just kind of sit around. It's a social event until you hear touchdown Alabama, until you hear Eli Gold say it or whoever their public announcer is, and then fans get excited and they leave probably halfway through just because I know you'd much rather be in their situation than where Arkansas is, but at the same time you're like, I wouldn't want to go to a team that I won 90-something percent of the games like all the time at home, just in the fashion they do. I'd want to win a lot, but not in the fashion they do because they just dominate everyone.
You want to see some suspense.
Yeah, a little bit. And that's weird me saying that. Like, I think what Arkansas had in 2010 and 2011 was awesome because they were virtually in every single game they played in. And you thought they were going to win a lot of games, but it was never a locked, done deal unless they were just playing some trash program. I think that Mississippi State with Dak Prescott, what Dan Mullen had was kind of cool. It's just, and it's a weird dynamic that you want to play. I think LSU's been in a pretty good position too, just because of the atmosphere that their fans are in, what it seems like every Saturday night in Death Valley. I what's your take on that real quick before you get in your next one?
On Death Valley or on?
Just,
well, here's what I think. We should all be so lucky to be as bored as Alabama fans. I think wouldn't it be nice to be choosy on the way you win games?
Yeah.
Instead of, do we have a show? Hey, two segments ago, our conversation was, what is essentially a moral victory for the team? You know, what's being competitive? And now we're kind of looking at the idea of being picky on how we'd like to win games. We should all be so lucky to be that bored. As Alabama football fans must be. We should also be so lucky, Ty, to have $1,131.99.
For what, Phil Elson? What is that for?
Well, you know, Halloween is coming up in about, what is it, 5 weeks?
October 31st.
The decorations are starting to pop up all over town. It's not too early for Halloween decorations. It's not too early for giant spiders and skeleton skulls and scary costumes outside the home, but if you've got $1,131.99, which by the way it is on sale because the initial price was a little bit over $1,400, then you can get yourself an amazing Halloween costume, a Batman Supreme armored costume, and the funniest part about this is that it says it's for adults. Well, I don't know how many kids' costumes would have molded armor, a real jumpsuit, a steel helmet, the cape, which looks like it's made of velvet. What is that, velvet? Real gloves? It's got gauntlets and boot top. This is a suit of armor. It doesn't say if the Batmobile or the utility belt comes with it, but I'm going to tell you what, for nearly $1,200, I better get some freaking shark spray.
That doesn't sound like something I would be investing my money in, Phil Elson, at all.
No, I don't think so at all. I got a tweet from someone asking, what did you spend on, what's the most you've ever spent on memorabilia? I got a fan who tweets at us. It's JT Carter, at Enter Soundman. He's got a whole host of signed balls and bats. It's all Arkansas stuff, signed helmets, signed basketballs. You know, looking at one of these here, that's the 1990 Final Four in Denver, signed by the entire team. He said he never spent a dime on it. That is...
How does he get that stuff? I saw that picture, too.
He must have very good connections.
Good grief. I wish I had those connections. I bought a 94 Charlotte. I wasn't there. I wasn't even born yet. But it's a Charlotte, North Carolina Final Four hat. And I wear that sparingly because it's a flat bill. And I think flat bills are for not... That's not my style. I don't want to dress like a tool all the time. So I have that. I'm trying to think some retro stuff that I have. I have a couple of my grandpa's old Arkansas stuff, which is like I've told you, I really like retro sports memorabilia. That's kind of my go-to when it comes to wearing stuff. I have a cool Final Four, I think it was 2007 sweatshirt. A lot of these events I haven't gone to, I like the just the apparel itself. So it's hard to beat good old sports apparel.
That's true. That's true. My favorite thing I've got right here is a signed bat of the Arkansas baseball team from this last year. I actually haven't been into the memorabilia too much. I might spend the money on the Batman costume before I asked an athlete for his autograph. Just not an autograph seeker. Never been a thing for me.
Subscribe to the show on iTunes. You're listening to the Halftime Podcast.
Trying to extend the play, and Brooks Ellis, pick six. Will it be? Yes. How about that?
Bob Holt of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette is about to join us.
Hey, Ed, how you doing?
How you been, Bob?
And we've got Bob Holt ready to go. Bob, how are you today? Good to have you with us.
I'm good. How you guys doing?
We're doing fantastic. Doing fantastic. So, I mean, the focus going into this game on Saturday, Arkansas-Auburn, is what Auburn had done the past 2 years. This is something you and Tom Murphy wrote about, the rushing yards, the ability to just overpower the Arkansas offense, the Arkansas defensive line and the approach there, and essentially jam it down their throats. Over 300 yards on the ground last year. It was over 500 the year before. And if you're Arkansas, if you got any chance in this ball game, you got to find a way to stop Auburn from running the ball at will, and that's what they've done the past 2 years.
Yeah, Arkansas, they need to try to limit that, obviously. And I'm not saying they can shut down the run, but Auburn's in a bit of a transition. Well, you know, they lost their top running backs from last year. They return offensive line, they only had 16 or 17 starts. They're in a bit of a transition there. And Arkansas, I think Arkansas's defensive line has actually played pretty decent. Obviously, it gets a big boost with Randy Ramsey coming back. So I'm not saying Auburn won't run well, but I don't like, for instance, I think 2 years ago, Eli Stove took a jet sweep and ran about 90 yards on the first play of the game. I don't anticipate that happening, though he is back from a knee injury. But, yeah, it's going to be a key for Arkansas. They've got to be physical up front. And even though Jarrett Stidham's a real good quarterback, you want to, you know, get him into some, you know, second and longs, third and longs, and see what you know, what kind of pressure you can put on him.
In your estimation, Bob, and you mentioned, you know, Randy Ramsey coming back with Armand Watts playing as he has. He's had a sack every game. They've gotten to the quarterback. I mean, they hit Mason Fine 9 times last week. I mean, it'll be a different story against Auburn. But in your estimation, if you're looking for a bright spot on the defense, has it been defensive line?
Yeah, I think the defensive line's played pretty well. They've had a decent rotation up there. I think, you know, the way Armand Watts has played inside has allowed them to put, you know, Sosa Game on the outside, where, you know, I think Game's a good player wherever you line him up, but I think he's more effective on the outside and be more disruptive out there. And you look at Arkansas, they forced a lot of fumbles. They don't have a ton of sacks, but they have, you know, pressure quarterbacks some. I'm not trying to say the defense played great last week because they gave up some big plays, but if you look at all the turnovers and the fact that Arkansas had a pick six and that crazy punt return, I really don't think defense was the big problem last week. Obviously, the big problem last week was the turnovers, but I think the defense has played okay, not outstanding, but I think they've played okay.
Bob Holt's our guest here on Halftime. He's covered the Razorbacks for a long time for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Bob, I got to ask you a straightforward question. Is this the worst Arkansas Razorbacks teams that you've covered since 1981?
Yeah, I thought about that, too. I tried to dodge the question. I'm going to say I want to let the season play out because I've definitely seen some bad games. I mean, I covered the Citadel loss. I covered the loss. You know, they lost to USC 70-17. All that obviously is basically an NFL team that USC had out there that year.
Maybe a better way to put it, Bob, maybe a better way to put the question is this the worst start to a season? You're mentioning some of the games that have started seasons, Citadel, USC, can even look to the ULM loss, Toledo, but these last 2 weeks just really seem to stand out amongst other starts to season. So don't look at it from the vantage point of the whole season. What about just maybe the worst start to a season that you've seen?
Yeah, I'd say losing all the respect to the group of five conferences or whatever they're called these days. But to lose to a Mountain West team and then a Conference USA team back-to-back, yeah, I don't remember a stretch quite like that. And I will say this was a bad year to play North Texas. I think they're really good. I won't be surprised if North Texas goes undefeated. And I think Colorado State was probably better than their record showed. But that being said, Arkansas, you know, should win both of those games. So they obviously want a Colorado State. And I'm not shocked North Texas beat them, but I think maybe I predicted, you know, a close high-scoring game. I guess I hit the high-scoring part for North Texas and not the close game part. But, yeah, for two games, for back-to-back games, you know, losing to non-conference teams like this that aren't from other power conferences, power five conferences, yeah, that probably is the worst back-to-back non-conference losses I can remember.
Bob, Gus Malzahn did not have a good relationship with Brett Bielema. He does have one with Chad Morris. Do you think possibly that will cause him to take the foot off the gas if this game gets out of hand late?
Well, I don't think Gus is going to run it up on Chad, if that's what you're asking. But I'm sure if somebody asked Gus that question at a press conference, you know, and it's a perfectly legitimate question. Believe me, I've thought about that too. But I'm sure Gus would just cringe at somebody asking him, basically, are you going to not go run up on your buddy Chad? You know, because coaches, they're always worried about everything. And, you know, if you're Auburn, you might think, like, well, Arkansas can't play any worse. There's nowhere to go but up, and they're coming in here as big underdogs. They're going to let it all hang out. But, yeah, I mean, if Auburn's winning by 30 points in the fourth quarter, I don't expect, you know, Gus to be throwing deep and have his starters in there or anything like that. But, you know, that being said, it's competitive. I mean, these guys are friends, but they're also in the SEC West, where basically it's you know, pretty cutthroat football. So, I don't expect if Gus has a chance to run up, I certainly don't expect him to do that. But I also don't think Gus is sitting there thinking about, well, when should I put my third string quarterback in the game? I mean, I think Gus, like all coaches, you know, he's worried about this game. It's an SEC West game, you know.
Bob Holt from the Democrat Gazette joining us. And I think it's interesting, going into this week on Monday, we knew who the starting quarterback was going to be. It's Ty's story. But we don't know necessarily who's going to be blocking for him at each position. And there have been some players practicing at new positions over this past few days. There's, you know, Noah Gatling has been wearing a green jersey. He has started at left tackle for the past couple of games. I know you got Yelte Froholt practicing at guard, Ty Clare getting some work at center. So there's been some shuffling on that offensive line. And we're not even really sure who will start at what position when it comes to Saturday.
Yeah, and obviously that's an area where you want cohesiveness and guys meshing. But unfortunately for Arkansas, that really hadn't been the case going back to the start of camp, because they've been hit so hard by injuries and different things. You know, Dalton Wagner had appendicitis, but Colton Jackson played, I think, about 26, 27 snaps last week. I expect him to be starting back at left tackle. You know, he was a projected starter there before he had that back surgery. Back much sooner. They estimated back in July he'd miss six games. He only missed two. And, I don't know what's going on with Noah Gatlin, but he had a green jersey on. But that's an indication he's out of practice. He can probably play. So I expect Colton Jackson to be out there at left tackle. The question would be, you know, in his second week back, how will his conditioning be? Will he be able to go, you know, 60 snaps or whatever? Yelte Froholt, I would imagine he'd be more comfortable starting left guard. That's where he started the last 2 years. On the other hand, Ty Clary, you know, he's got some starting experience last year and this year, but do you really want a guy's first start at center to be at Jordan-Hare Stadium, where he's got to, you know, call out the signals and get those shotgun snaps back? So I don't know who's going to start center. I just have to believe it's going to be Yelte Froholt, because I don't think you have a true sophomore, you know, make his first start such a crucial position. But it's possible. You know, I mean, they're basically trying to get the best five guys out there, the best combination. And obviously, you know, the offensive line has struggled. So, you know, they may just be trying different things out.
I saw Coach Morris referring to the thought of, we're trying to cross-train some guys, which I think in his mind means, you know, taking guys out of one position, trying them at another position. I want to ask about what's going on at cornerback. You wrote about the thought of perhaps have needing to, out of necessity, trying Cameron Curl at cornerback as part of that rotation, taking him out of the safety position. So the injury bug has really started to hit that secondary now, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously Ryan Pulley's, you know, very solid guy at the one cornerback spot, and at the other spot that's kind of been a revolving door. Chevin Callaway was a guy the first couple games, and then Chad hasn't been specific, but saying he has personal reasons. You know, he has not, didn't play last week, hadn't been to practice this week, so he's obviously not going to play. And then you had, you know, Brito Tutt, a guy that's had some knee injuries in the past, started, and then he had to leave. And so, yeah, you've got some young guys out there, you know, Monteric Brown and Jarquez McKellion, you know, Nate Dalton. So, you know, they tried a lot of different guys over there last week. And, you know, I think Cameron Curl, if he could clone himself, that'd be a great solution. He could play corner and safety, but he obviously can't play both. And he's been so good at safety, and he added, I think, 10 or 12 pounds in the offseason, being more physical. So I think maybe they feel like, even though Curl, well, I thought, played pretty well as a true freshman last year at corner, are you weakening yourself at two position by putting a guy that's built to be a safety now at corner, and then, you know, who do you put at safety to replace him, even though you've had some, you know, you'd have to put a true freshman in there probably, either Joe Fuchsia or Miles, you know. I don't know. I don't think the answer is moving Curl, although, you know, you'd love to put him at corner, but then you just weaken yourself at safety. So I think they're going to go with one of those younger guys at corner. Well, plus another thing, they got Kevin Richardson back this week, which is huge. Now, he has not played all year, but he's a veteran guy. He's actually a sixth-year guy. So he's normally a nickel back, but you could put Kevin Richardson out there at corner. The question is, how many snaps could you realistically get out of him, you know, his first game back?
Bob Holt's our guest. You can follow him on Twitter at BobHoltADG. Bob, you've seen a number of different Razorback coaches come through the football ranks. What do you think the hardest part is about players transitioning from coach to coach?
Oh, I think it's, I guess maybe this is a cliche, but probably the buying factor. You know, Todd Graham spoke at the Northwest Arkansas Touchdown Club yesterday. He's the guy that hired both Gus Malzahn and Chad to be his offensive coordinator at Tulsa. But, you know, these guys, except for the true freshmen, they were all recruited by a different staff, you know. Now, some of the linemen are playing for John Scott, who's a holdover, and Barry Lunny's a holdover as the tight ends coach. But for the vast majority of these guys, they were recruited by, you know, different staff. They were recruited to play different styles. On offense, it's a really radical change, you know. Todd Graham talked about this. I mean, you're going from a huddle-up deal where you're trying to shorten the game, and you kind of want these big hulking linemen, all of a sudden you're trying to speed up the game to where you're almost at a fifth quarter. Although for this team, you kind of wonder if shorting the game might be a better way to go. But yeah, it's just a totally different style. These quarterbacks are recruited to play this style. So I think the big thing is, you know, you want buy-in. And Todd Graham said the best way to buy in is to win, and they haven't done that yet. So I think when things don't go right, there are a lot of guys probably questioning, you know, either they're not playing as much as they think they should, or they're not playing where they think they should, or, you know, if you're a receiver, you're not getting the ball, or if you're running back, you're not getting the ball, or if you're on defense, they're not calling your number to blitz or whatever. So, I just think there's a lot of buy-in that needs to take place, probably hadn't taken place yet. And if you look at it, it's not just Arkansas, and I'm not making excuses for them, but if you look at UCLA, Nebraska, Florida State, there are a lot of teams with new coaches struggling, and some of that's talent, obviously, but I think a lot of it is just, you know, players struggle with the transition sometimes.
Saturday, I don't think they're going to win. Phil doesn't think they're going to win. I'm going to assume that you're not going to think they're going to win. What is a number, what is a point differential that if you're an Arkansas coach, or you for that matter, Bob, that you would be, okay, they kept it competitive?
Well, yeah, and I think Auburn's going to win. I don't know. I mean, sometimes you watch a game and it's 30 points and you think, wow, that thing was a blowout. And maybe there were some, you know, things that happened at the end that made it, you know, the margin bigger. And sometimes there are games that are real close and you think, wow, that was a close game. And nah, it really wasn't, you know. So I would think if Arkansas could keep them a couple touchdowns, that would be, encouraging to fans. But, I mean, more than the point differential, you know, if I'm an Arkansas fan, I just want to see, can these, like Chad Morris has talked about, simplifying the offense, cutting back on things, being able to do, you know, even if we can only run, you know, four or five plays, he said, let's run those four or five plays really well. So if you're an Arkansas fan, you know, I would, you know, I think you want to see, you know, can they execute better offensively? Can they cut down their turnovers? You know, can they put some pressure on the quarterback? Can they limit the run game? I think you just want to see progress. I think if you watch the game, you know, throughout, you'll get an idea of if they made progress or not against a really quality opponent. So, yeah, point differential, you know, I guess that helps you decide how competitive the game was. But I think, you know, it's more about the eye test.
Bob, always a pleasure to have you with us on Thursdays. Looking forward to reading what you got in the paper tomorrow, your coverage of the game on Saturday. Of course, you can find him in the Democrat Gazette. Bob Holt with us all every Thursday. Thanks so much, Bob. Have a great rest of the day.
Okay, you guys take care.
Winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. You're listening to the Halftime Podcast.